Thanks for listening to Stokely and Zach On Demand. Before Zach tells us who is moonwalking in the Hall of Fame today, have you subscribed to our podcast? Subscribe everywhere you get your podcast or at 1043thefan.com. Can
we be there? And we are here. James Marlett from 1043thefan.com sitting in for Zach By. In his usual perch, however, is Brandon Stokely. Stoke, how you doing today?
I'm doing great, man. Good to be here. Glad that you are joining me today and looking forward to a great show. How's everything going?
Things are good. Things are good. I'm a little bummed just as a sports fan, as someone who grew up in Colorado, rooting for the Rockies, rooting for the Nuggets. You know, two teams that kind of get under your skin, and, you know, a lot of it is probably just jealousy that they, you know, seem to have a good team every year, and they win championships, and they have money to burn. But, you know, it's the Lakers, and it's the Dodgers. And what, about a month ago, maybe not even that long ago, a couple of weeks ago, we had to watch LeBron James and the Lakers win the championship down in the bubble in Orlando. And then last night, I had to watch, I mean, I was rooting hard for the Rays. I was pulling for them. All of a sudden, I had this, like, Tampa Bay allegiance that I didn't know I could possibly have, and then last night had to watch the Dodgers win it and win the World Series. So it's been a tough couple of weeks, tough month here for Colorado sports fans.
Yeah, I'm with you. You know, I was pulling for LA to lose, the Lakers, and I was pulling for the Dodgers to lose, and I became a big Rays fan also. Man, I tell you what, that manager just, I mean, you talk about a boneheaded move right there and just an all-timer. You cannot pull Blake Snell in the sixth inning there when he is rolling and he's already got one out and he gives up one hit in that inning. He's only given up two for the whole game. He was dealing. You don't take that guy out. I mean, what are you doing? That's just one of the dumbest moves in a big-time moment by a manager. Just flat-out dumb. I mean, how can you do that? He is one. He's probably the ace of the staff, and you make that type of move in that type of moment when he is pitching so well, I just don't get it.
Well, you know, we're going to start off, I guess, on a high note here because I disagree with you. And I know I'm in the
what?
I'm in
what? How could you disagree?
Hear me out. I'm in the minority on this. I get it. And it didn't work out. Like, it could not have worked out worse, right? The guy he brings in gives up the double and then has the wild pitch. Like, it was just a disaster. But here's sort of my way of looking at it. That this way of managing and this whole analytics-driven thing and way about going about baseball is how the Rays got there, right? They had the fourth lowest payroll in baseball heading into the season. You know, it all kind of changed with people opting out and all that kind of stuff. But at the start of the year, when, you know, before COVID and everybody got to spring training, they had the fourth lowest payroll in all of baseball. They made it all the way to the World Series. They followed this formula. This is what they do. So I think in a pressure situation with the season on the line, I think you have to stay the course. I think you have to continue to do what you've always done and do what got you there. Don't go changing things and, you know, all of a sudden you're using your gut and you're going back to kind of the old school baseball manager thing. I think if you're an analytics guy, always be an analytics guy. You got to be steady. And here's how I kind of evaluate these kind of things. And maybe this isn't the right way to do it, but it's how my brain works. I think about it of like, well, which one would I kick myself for doing more? So if I'm the manager, if I'm Kevin Cash, and I don't do what I've done all season long, and I decide, you know what, I'm not going to follow the numbers, I'm not going to use the stats, I'm not going to use the analytics, I'm going to stick with Snell, and we're going to let him pitch, and it doesn't work, man, I'd be kicking myself saying, why didn't I do what I always do?
Didn't they bring in a righty? And the numbers say that Mookie Betts struggles more against lefties. And so yes, exactly. Well, I mean, that's what we're doing. We're looking at this year. So analytics wasn't his reason. He didn't say, you know, after the game that, you know what, I based it solely on analytics. He said, hey, I just had a feeling about it. So that was his approach. It wasn't like the analytics told me to pull him out after giving up one hit. No, the analytics would have told you to leave him in.
I just would kick myself.
So your point is really not valid when it comes to analytics now. That goes out the window, James.
But that's why he did it. It's the third time through the lineup, right? Because it was the number nine hitter that it was Austin Barnes who got the hit. And then it's like, hey, third time through the lineup, you know,
that's hogwash.
Hit hard.
That's bogus.
But that's his rationale.
His rationale was he just felt like it was time for him to be pulled out of the game. And it made no sense. It was a boneheaded manager decision in that moment, and it cost his team in a big way because I believe Blake Snell could have gone at least eight innings the way he was dealing. And obviously, look what happens now when you make that type of move and you take your ace out and the guy that is absolutely dealing, you just pull him out because he gives up one hit in that inning. And that was ridiculous. Awful move by that guy.
Here's my analogy. Let me try this one on you.
No, it's not going to work.
No. Just hear me out.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay. So you go
you
in.
Lost you know. The first one. Now you're going to try another one. I see how you do this.
I wouldn't have kicked myself for that.
I see. Go ahead.
I could have looked myself in the mirror by going with what I always do. That was the first thing. So here's the other analogy on it. Every time I walk through a casino, right, I got to walk by the roulette wheel, and I got to put a 5 on number 20.
Sure.
Right? And if I put that 5 on 20 and it doesn't hit, you know, I'm kind of expecting that, right? Like, I don't really kick myself. I'm figuring, like, you know, that's a 1 in 38 chance it wasn't going to hit. I walked through the casino.
Those odds down.
Well, you got to count the double zeros. They now have triple zeros. That makes them 1 in 39. That's a whole other thing. But anyhow, so I put the 5 down. If it doesn't hit, I'm not kicking myself. That's what I always do. If I'm walking through the casino and I decide, you know what? I sat on in row 18 on the way out here. I'm going to put the 5 on 18. And then it hits 20. Man, I'm really going to be kicking myself. I didn't do what I always do. Like, I should have just stayed consistent. That's kind of how I think he's looking at this bet.
No. Every situation is different in sports. You don't just always follow the book and follow what you always do. You have to be able to adapt to a game situation in the moment, and that's why you're getting paid. Look, if it was just like, hey, read the book here and just go put this lineup out, read the book here and just say, okay, you know, we're going to go red 20 every time. We don't even need a manager. Anybody can manage.
Sure,
you have to have some kind of instinct to be able to manage during a game when it might be off course a little bit. How is the game going? What's the flow of the game? That determines everything. That's where good managers separate themselves from bad managers. Excuse me, great managers separate themselves from just average managers because they have that feel. They know when to push the button and when not to push the button. That's why you're the manager. Not because you can read a book and you do the same thing over and over and over again. 2-0.
I just like the consistency of it.
You want to keep going?
No, no. Huh? I like the consistency of it. It's what bothered me about John Fox, right? And it's kind of what bothers me about Vic Fangio at times. Look, I don't like a conservative head coach. I'd rather have, you know, Riverboat Ron. That's just kind of more my style.
Yeah. I think most people are like that. Most people want an aggressive coach until it doesn't work. You know, then they're like, well, why'd you do it?
But my problem with Foxy would be, if you're going to be conservative, right? It was a little bit with Fangio in the opener against Tennessee. You want to be a conservative head coach. You want to play games. You try to win 17-14. Then you know what you do on 4th and goal from the 2? You kick the field goal. You take the 3 points. That's the conservative answer. You don't roll the dice and all of a sudden become Riverboat Ron. That's not your nature. That's not how your team is built. That's not what you do. You don't go with your gut of like, man, I really think this shovel pass to the tight end is going to work here.
No, James, you're wrong again. You read the book and you take your field goal. So I'm like
3-0 now.
You're wrong again. Just let me go ahead and put you in check again. To start the show, I mean, it's going to be an 0-3 for you, and we're only 10 minutes into this thing. Listen, good coaches adapt on the fly. You can't just have one mindset and say, this is how I coach. You can't say, I'm going to be aggressive all the time. No, that doesn't work. Sometimes you got to be aggressive. Sometimes you need to be conservative. Riverboat Ron, he doesn't go for it on 4th down every time, 4th and short. He doesn't do that. Sometimes the situation calls for it, and then you do it. Other times, it doesn't call for it. And so I think that's the best approach. That's the approach that I like as a player. I don't want a coach that's just going to, you know, throw caution to the wind and just be, you know, aggressive to a fault. And I certainly don't want a coach that's just going to be conservative all the time. I want a guy that's going to adapt to different situations. And, you know, one that comes to mind is a Mike Shanahan, you know, playing for Mike. I mean, he was great at those types of things. You remember the Chargers game when he went for the 2-point conversion?
Yep.
Well, Mike
yep.
wasn't always going for, you know, crazy things like that. He felt in the moment that that was the right play and the right call. And he knew that, you know, we were on the ropes and overtime probably wouldn't have looked good for us. So, you know, in that moment, you say, you know what, we're going to go for it and we're going to try to finish the game right here. So I think every situation's unique, and you got to be, as a coach and a manager, be able to adapt to those situations, in-game situations. You can't have somebody just write a script for you and just say, I'm going to be an aggressive coach or I'm going to be a conservative coach. Every situation is unique, and you have to adapt to that situation in the moment. And that's what separates great ones from good ones, from average ones. And who was it, Kevin Cash or whatever his name is?
Yep.
He dropped the ball in a big way last night, and he let his team down.
I just, you know, I guess for me, if I'm Kevin Cash and I wake up this morning and I let Snell pitch against my better judgment, against what I've always done, and he gets shelled the third time through the lineup.
But why is that what you've always done? Like, why is that what you've always done?
That's just what they do. They're like the computer-driven team. I don't like it. I'm not necessarily an analytics guy.
He didn't say analytics called for this, and that's what we've done all year, so I just stuck with the book. That's not what he said. Well, so that's why I'm having a hard time with it.
But that's what he did. That's what he did. It was to me, it was all about the, hey, third time through, Snell tends to get shelled. It's time to pull him out. He just gave up a hit. Okay, that's warning sign. Here we go. I'm gonna stick with what we do. I'm gonna stick with how we run this organization. You know, kind of the money ball analytics type of thing. And that's what they went with. But look, no matter which way he went, it was all about what's the result, right? If he leaves in Snell and he gets shelled, well, he's going to get second-guessed.
I don't think he would have. Like, who would have second-guessed leaving your best pitcher on the mound in the sixth inning? It wasn't the ninth inning.
You're right.
Two hits in that moment. He had an out. So I don't think anybody's going to ever second-guess you for leaving your best pitcher in there in the sixth stinking inning. It wasn't the ninth. He wasn't throwing 130 pitches. So it was like, that's just the norm. The norm is leaving your pitcher in there when he is dealing. He wants the ball. He's telling you he wants the ball, and you pull him out. Now the magnifying glass goes on what happens next, and obviously it didn't work out well for him. And so, yeah, he should be scrutinized for that move because it was an awful move, and it cost his team in a big way.
It certainly would have been
shame on him.
Safer
and
move
shame on you
to just leave him in there because then he wouldn't have, you know, everybody second-guessing him today. But the result is what bothered me because I was rooting for the Rays. I would have loved to watch Game 7 tonight.
Yes,
that would have been a ton of fun.
Exactly. That's why I'm bummed. I won in Game 7, and I was rooting for the Rays. So I think probably that makes me a little bit more upset about it. And then maybe one other thing that we won't talk about right now, but there's a couple things that made me upset about it. And you know, now no more baseball. And I wanted to see nothing better than Game 7s, right? Everything's on the line here. Let's see what it looks like. And the Rays really squandered opportunities early in that baseball game, though. That's what we also have to remember. The first and second inning, they had chances to put 3, 4, 5 runs up on the board, and it's a different ball game. But instead, they only scored that one run, and that was it. And I think that's where they're really kicking themselves today, was not taking advantage of those opportunities early in the game.
Well, and I just happened to be driving around a little bit last night, was listening to the game here on The Fan, and the announcers talked about that of – hey, you know what? If it's not 1-0, if it's even 2-0, certainly if it's 3-0, they probably leave Snell in, right? Because there's a little bit more margin for error if he gives up the hit and then gives up a home run. All right.
Oh, analytics don't say to take him out then, I guess.
No, I think it does change. If it's 1-0, we got no margin for error. I think that changes it. But one other thing tied to the World Series. I don't know if you saw this last night. And normally the Rockies kind of drive me crazy. Their Twitter's fantastic. Whoever runs their Twitter account is great. It's hilarious. They do some really creative things, but they bother me a little bit when they, you know, say things that are meant to be funny and when they just lost, or when they, you know, they lose a series and they post their, you know, here's our fancy menu on the flight home and stuff like that. That seems a little tone deaf, but I thought they hit the tone perfect last night with their tweet after the Dodgers won. The Rockies tweeted, congratulations to Colorado Rockies, the only team to beat the Dodgers in a series this year. That's actually, it's funny, patting yourself on the back for something. It's also kind of remarkable. That's the only series the Dodgers lost all year long. That's hard to, I know it's only a 60-game season, but still.
That's impressive.
I think the right team, as much as I hate to say it, probably won the World Series. If you only lost one series all year, hard to believe it was the Rockies, but
impressive. That's not the way it works. You know, I mean, they have to finish it off in the postseason, and, you know, they fell behind 3-1 to Atlanta, and they were able to claw back and get that series win. So they were the most complete baseball team this year. They were on the brink of elimination there, and they stepped up. They stepped up in a big way, and they finished it off. So different baseball season this year with only 60 games, but I was intrigued. I was entertained, and the postseason was good. They had some good moments, and so I thought that Rays game, game four, I think it was. Yeah, game four was unbelievable with the guy falling down, getting back up and scoring the game-winning run. That was awesome. Was watching with my son, and we were going crazy. So that was just, you know, they had some big moments, some cool moments and fun moments. So I was glad that, and they finished it off. What'd you make of, what was it, Trey Turner, testing positive in the eighth inning? They tell him he's got to leave the game, and then he comes back out on the field, and he's taking pictures with no mask or anything. It's like, wait, holy cow, what is going on here? What'd you make of that?
It just, to me, and, you know, I saw this a little bit on Twitter, and I agreed with it. It just sort of kind of defines 2020, right? Like, it's just so bizarre that he tested positive the day before, but they didn't let him know until, like, the sixth inning, and then he has to come out of the game, but then he's out there. Like, none of it made any sense, right? And, like, I think everybody kind of wants to do the right thing, but we never know what to do because it all doesn't make any sense. A little bit like, you know, now we're in, what, phase three or whatever in Denver, and, you know, businesses can't have certain number of people in there once again, but the Broncos, they could still have 5,700 fans because they get a pass. Like, why? It's either dangerous or not dangerous. Like, none of this stuff adds up. So last night, that's kind of what's going through my head of like, well, of course this makes no sense because nothing seems to have made any sense. I mean, it would have been kind of a bummer for him to not be able to be out there celebrating, but I think that's probably the responsible thing to have done is not be out there celebrating. But then you would
His
say
teammates didn't care.
Yeah, well, they've been in the locker room in the dugout with him anyway, right?
Yeah.
So it's like, well, what's the difference? You were with him for six innings, another 15 minutes out there celebrating.
Yeah, I think that's
make
a good
the difference.
Right, exactly. That's a good point.
So
just really, really odd and weird
it
how
was.
That worked, and you get pulled in the eighth inning. I was so upset. I was so upset and so mad. I stopped watching it. I would follow it on my phone. And if it became a good game, I was going to turn it back on. But I was so pissed off at that manager, Kevin Cash, that I was like, they're losing now. They're not going to win. So I turned the darn thing off and did other things. And then I looked and it was 3-1. I'm like, okay, this dang thing's over. So it was, but I didn't even know until this morning when I was reading up and I saw it. I was like, oh my gosh, wow, how crazy is that? And then, on top of that, like, what was the testing process? Are they not testing every day? What is going on with their testing process that it would be delayed that long?
Testing every day.
I don't understand that. That was
weird.
Then
what's the point if you don't get the results until the game has already started? Right? Like, that just – it seems like you should have got the results, even if the test is the day before. You got to get the results, like, before everybody comes to the clubhouse and the day starts. Because once that's happened – you know, the old cat's out of the bag kind of thing. So it was just bizarre. Hey, real quick, to totally change gears, but a piece of breaking news here from Mike Kliss, our Broncos insider from 9 News. Broncos offensive line coach Mike Munchak is not at practice today as he is in COVID protocol. This means Munchak either came in contact with someone who had coronavirus or he tested positive with virus spike in metro area. Not surprised by this. So Mike Munchak.
Wow.
It's now in the COVID protocol. This is what I was talking about with, you know, when the Patriots game had to get moved and everybody was the team was saying, hey, we didn't do anything wrong. Why are we suffering?
Right.
That
right.
boomerang shaped stone that they were throwing.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Now, are you
that
saying now
one.
Mike Munchak did something wrong? Or is it just, hey, this is affecting a lot of people. You never know when it's going to hit you. And you just kind of hope it doesn't hit your team, but it's more of a cross your fingers than anything else. So, we'll see what comes of this. So hopefully it's something they were able to, you know, nip in the bud and get him quarantined and it doesn't spread. But Mike Munchak not at practice today because he's in the COVID protocol. That's breaking news out of Dove Valley.
Yeah, that's you're right though. You know, we dealt with this when we were trying to play the Patriots, right? And and going through that and you could sense the frustration on the Broncos' part and some of the players. And you did. You made a good point then, and it becomes even more true now when you look at the Broncos situation. Look, I mean, sometimes it can just happen, right? It might not be anybody's fault. It can just happen here, and, you know, hopefully it's just Mike Munchak, and that's really it. But obviously it could impact a lot of players, and the Broncos could be the ones that are making a game be postponed or moved
because of,
you know, all of a sudden that they have a lot of tests that are positive. So we'll see what happens here. Obviously, their running back coach, which we haven't talked a lot about, he was out for a while. You know, he didn't make the trip to New England because he tested positive. And now Mike Munchak I guess it's probably been, you know, a week and a half later, he's testing positive for it, or he's been in contact with somebody. Is that is that right?
Yeah, correct.
They didn't say that he tested positive.
Right.
He could have been just in close contact with somebody that did test positive.
Yeah, it's one of the two. But you start to, you know, kind of spin it forward a little bit, and you think back to last week when the Raiders had, wasn't it their entire offensive line that didn't practice because they were out while they were waiting to get tested and to come back negative, and how that could impact them. Well, you know, you start looking at, all right, it's Mike Munchak. That's the group he's working with. He's in that room all the time. You know, this thing could have all sorts of implications. So hopefully it's just he came in contact with somebody, he's negative, and it's not something that's going to kind of spread like wildfire through the rooms and through the locker room and all that kind of stuff. But certainly something to keep an eye on as we head into this weekend's game. And, you know, it'll have some sort of impact. Hopefully it's relatively minor, but it's going to have some impact.
Well, sure. I mean, hopefully it's just, you know, he might not have it, and he can test negative a couple times coming up here and be clear to return. Or, you know, if he can't, hopefully it doesn't spread. And then, you know, because they do have two offensive line coaches. I was teammates with the other one, their assistant offensive line coach, Chris Cooper.
Yep.
He's been coaching now for, I don't know, 5 or 6 years in the NFL. He's very competent coach. He was a really good football player, obviously, and so they'll be fine up front. They'll be fine if Mike Munchak's not available to coach them up. Chris Cooper will do a great job, so we'll see. We'll see how it goes for Mike Munchak. Hopefully, it's not anything major, and hopefully, it's not spread amongst anybody else in that building, and it's just business as usual.
Hey, Stoke, yesterday I was listening to you and Zach, and I know we disagreed on Kevin Cash, but yesterday when I'm listening to you guys, you were talking about this defense and how they were upset at the offense and all that kind of stuff. Could not have agreed with you more.
Wow,
so
there we go.
Exactly. I want to get, you know, let you kind of reset your thoughts and I'll share mine. Plus, talking about analytics, wait till you hear the latest on what analytics are saying about one of the most maligned Broncos of all time. We'll share those numbers coming up next. Stoke, yesterday during the show, you and Zach were talking about the news that was breaking out of Dove Valley, some of the sound bites that came out of yesterday's press conferences. I think it was Noah Fant who talked about how some of the frustration that we saw on the sideline out of Bradley Chubb, Shelby Harris, how it carried over into the locker room. And basically he insinuated that the defense was frustrated with the offense, and that's where some of that anger came from. And Noah Fant, to his credit, you know, basically said, hey, I can see why they're upset. We gotta hold up our end of the bargain. You didn't think it was a great sign that the defense was upset with the offense. I don't want to put words in your mouth, but that's essentially what you were saying yesterday. You didn't take this as a positive that the defense was starting to call out the other side of the ball.
No, not at all. I think when you look at the situation, first of all, this defense is not like they're all that great to begin with, right? So I don't think they can be throwing shade to anybody, and certainly not the offense. And then I think, secondly, you need to look at the situation, and if you're a defender or if you're a defensive player or an offensive player, you got to know where the strength is on your football team coming into the season. Obviously, the money has been spent on the defensive side of the football. They spent more money in cap as far as cap space goes on the defense than any team in the NFL.
Yep.
So that's where all the resources are, is on the defensive side of the football. They should be playing special defense. They should be playing top five defense, top three defense, and they haven't been playing that well. They've just been an average defense, if you ask me. So I would say, hey, you know, let's just be careful here pointing fingers right now, because y'all are not that great. Y'all have more resources in the offense. And, oh, by the way, the offense is a very young group. So yelling and screaming at them to do better and to, you know, come on, why aren't y'all scoring more points? Stop putting us in bad situations. That's not going to help those guys. I promise you. It's not going to make them play smarter or play better. So I think when you look at those things, you got to say, hey, you know what? You got to be patient here. You got to be patient here. And I was on a team that had a great offense and maybe not so great defense with the Colts.
Right, right.
And yes, it can be frustrating. But you know what? For the most part, we upheld our end of the bargain. But still, there was no, you know, pointing fingers. Would you get frustrated at those guys sometimes? Sure. But at the same time, our mindset was always, hey, we got to score more points than those guys. It don't matter if they give up a touchdown every time. We got to score one more time than them. I just don't like the approach from this team. Defense isn't that good to start pointing fingers and yelling at the offense for not doing enough.
Yeah, and, you know, I mean, I guess in a perfect world, you would set up a team to where both the offense and defense are equally good. I just think that very rarely happens. I think usually one side of the ball is, you know, the dominant phase. With this team, since 2015, it's been the defense, or they've tried to make it the defense. You know, this is similar to what we heard in 2016 when Aqib Talib got upset with Russell Okung trying to, you know, kind of talk after a loss in the locker room. I think that was to the Chiefs as well, if memory serves. And Aqib didn't want to hear anything of it. I didn't like that then because I thought that was the wrong approach, but at least that defense could look at it and say, hey, we carried this team to a Super Bowl title. Like, we've done something. We've accomplished something. We make plays. My problem with this group is, yeah, maybe the numbers in certain statistics are fine, but this isn't a group that makes plays, right? Like, you can look at the opener as an example. They gave up 16 points to the Titans. Okay, that's a pretty good performance. But you had the lead with 3 minutes left, and the Titans pinned all the way back at, what, their 10-yard line? Like, if you're a great defense, I don't care if it's 14-13 or 28-27. The points don't matter to me in terms of what's been done the rest of the game. The game is on the line. It's in your hands. And you let Ryan Tannehill go down there and set up Guskowski for a chip shot to win the game. That's on the defense.
Yep.
They had the game in their hands, and they blew it. And we could go through. I could go through every game. I could find five or six from last year. It happens time after time after time. I'm failing off the top of my head, other than the Houston game last year, to come up with an example of this defense, the Vic Fangio defense, making a play where I said, that's why they won the game. That was the turning point. They just don't do it.
Well, and I think when you look at it, and Bradley Chubb's talking about trying to be that leader, right, mm-hmm. that leader of the team, that's not a good way to lead. It's just not a good way to lead when you haven't won anything, when you've never really have done anything as a team here in the last 3 years, or really as an individual. It's not a good way to take over that leadership role and just start yelling when things don't go your way and the other side of the football isn't playing well. That's right. Not a good way to lead at all. I think leadership is better, especially when things are going bad, to lift up your offense, to try to pump those guys up and to get their confidence up, not beat them down. That's the wrong way to lead in this situation. I think when things are going well, that's when you're the hardest on guys. When things are going bad, man, you need to pick guys up, especially on the offensive side of the football, when you got a lot of young pieces over there and impressionable guys. And then on top of that, look, they've had no offseason. It's a new offense. It's a young quarterback. I mean, a lot of young pieces there. It's going to be some struggles throughout the course of the year. They're going to put you in some bad situations, defense. Just deal with it and try to lift those guys up and not, you know, bring them down.
I thought the other thing that was maybe the most telling when Bradley Chubb was talking yesterday was when he said, you know, we got a lot of guys looking around trying to find somebody to follow. Essentially, I'm paraphrasing, but, you know, looking and listening, trying to get some leadership. Basically admitting there's nobody currently doing that. That there's just this leadership void. We've all kind of talked about it for the last, I don't know, couple, 3 weeks, maybe more seriously than before. But once Vaughn got hurt and he started losing some veterans, and maybe even during the offseason we talked about it. But there doesn't seem to be any leadership. And I think, and you know, I've been critical of Vic Fangio. That's no surprise. But I think that starts at the top, right? Like, this kind of stuff happening, that's on the head coach. He's the guy who has to outline and make sure his defense knows exactly what you expressed when we first started talking about this. Hey, guys, we're the highest paid group on this team. We're supposed to carry him to victory. We can't count on them to do anything. Anything they do is a bonus. It's on us to go win football games. That needed to be Vic Fangio's approach. But that's never been Vic Fangio's approach.
No.
He chucks the offense, whether it's Rich Gangarello or his quarterback or whoever, under the bus and points the finger at blame at them all the time when it's his defense that repeatedly lets the team down. It's just, it doesn't surprise me that there's a leadership void. because I don't think they have a guy at the top who's very good at it.
Yeah, look, and being frustrated is fine.
Sure.
You know, look, I've been frustrated with defenses before. I've had defenses be frustrated with our offense. It kind of is what it is. That stuff happens, right? You're competing. But, you know, when it starts becoming a yelling and screaming thing at the end of the game in the locker room, that's when it becomes a little bit too much, right?
Well,
can take a really negative effect on the football team. So I think, look, yelling, screaming, you know, hey, maybe yelling at a player or getting in a disagreement with a player on the sideline or yelling at the coach and coach yelling back at you. Okay, that stuff happens, right? You kind of move on. Everybody's able to put it behind you. But when you get in the locker room after the game, you know, you need to take a deep breath there and not take it out on your teammate on the other side of the football. I think that's when it can become a bigger deal than what it should be.
Well, now, and I think I have this right, but I just want to make sure I'm not mixing stories up. Now, you were on the Ravens team that went that long stretch without scoring a touchdown, right?
Yes.
And you still went on to win a Super Bowl?
That's right.
What was the locker room like? What was the defensive leaders when your offense was sputtering and struggling so badly it was like a 5-game stretch. I mean, it wasn't like it was a week or two. It was a while.
It was like 4 games, I think, 4 or 5 games. Yeah.
Tony Banks got benched, right? Yep. And you guys went to Dilfer.
That's right. Good memory there. It was fine. Look, the defense knew, and the defense was great. They had great leaders over there, obviously, when you look at Ed Reed and Rod Woodson and, you know, Tony Siragusa and guys like that. I mean, some just true pros. And so, look, I mean, leadership wasn't a problem there. And there was never any infighting, never any pointing of the fingers. And, you know, like you said, your head coach needs to be a big part of that. And our head coach was an offensive guy. So imagine that for him. I mean, you
right.
know, he's an offensive. He's supposed to be the quote-unquote, you know, at that time he was an offensive guru. They had scored the most points 2 years before in Minnesota when he was with, you know, Randall Cunningham and Randy Moss and Chris Carter, and now he's the offensive coordinator with the Ravens. He's supposed to fix the offense, and we couldn't score 10 points a game. So, look, it was a tough situation for us, but there was never any finger-pointing from the defensive side. And certainly those guys could have done it because they were special, and
right.
we were just downright awful. But we didn't have any of that. And I think that is one of the reasons why we got our stuff together and got it going in the right direction and ended up winning the Super Bowl that year. Can you imagine that?
Right.
Can you
imagine
that? That was the year where we won the Super Bowl and we didn't score a touchdown in 4 or 5 straight games, and we went on to win a Super Bowl that year.
I mean, imagine if this offense has not been good.
No,
but
it's been awful.
Everybody freaked out when they only scored 6 field goals against the Patriots. You guys went for a month, more than a month, without scoring a touchdown, and it was still able to keep it on the tracks and you know, go to the playoffs and get to the Super Bowl and win it. I just think that, you know, and it's also funny to me, it's coming off of a week where, you know, and you could see it happening during the game. Everybody's talking about, the defense is playing pretty good. At the end of the day, they gave up 29 points defensively. It's not like they shut down Kansas City. Kansas City only ran 51 plays. 15 of them went for 10 yards or more. If Kansas City could have done a lot more if they needed to.
In a snowstorm, too, by the way, right?
Right.
You know, so
right.
it's not like the defense was that great. And Kansas City just did what they had to do to win the football game. It wasn't like, okay, hey, because I felt like if they wanted to, they could have thrown for 350 yards.
Yeah.
They could have ran
yeah.
the ball for whatever. They could have done whatever they wanted. Now, the interception, the kickoff return, those things don't help, obviously. But at the same time, it wasn't like you were just out there flat-out dominant defense.
Right. They were average and maybe even a little bit below average by the end of the game. So I just thought it was a bad look all around. All right, hey, a little bit of good news, though, if you're a Broncos fan. Pro Football Focus, who sometimes I take their numbers with a little bit of a grain of salt, but they're kind of the analytic that we can use to, you know, evaluate guys on the Broncos roster with players from other teams. And, you know, it's kind of the industry standard. They came out with their latest rankings yesterday. And one position was a little bit shocking in terms of who was atop the list. So in terms of the highest graded tackles in the NFL, number 5 from the Texans was Laremy Tunsil. Not surprising. He was an All-Pro last year. Number 4 from San Francisco was Trent Williams. Not surprising. He got traded there. He got a big contract. 3 from the Packers was David Bakhtiari. 2 from the Rams, the veteran Andrew Whitworth. None of those names surprised anyone. Multiple Pro Bowls, really, really good players, highly paid guys. Number 1 on the list from your Denver Broncos, number 72, Garrett Bowles.
How about that?
The highest rated tackle in the NFL through, what are we through, week six? That's, I mean, that's not the full
season
sample.
No, we're through week seven.
Week seven.
Six
games. That's a full sample size, right? Like, that's a pretty full sample size. Like, you know, rating of 91.2, that's a little something to be, you know, feeling good about if you're a Broncos fan.
Yeah, yeah, certainly. And then you look at some of the guys he's had to go against. You know, you look at a Bud Dupree for the Pittsburgh Steelers and a T.J. Watt. Buccaneers, you know, whether it be Shaq Barrett or JPP.
Yeah.
I mean, so he's had to go against some decent pass rushes there. Titans, you got Jadeveon Clowney. So it's not like he's faced guys that can't get after the quarterback. And it continues this week. We'll see what he looks like against Bosa and Melvin Ingram with the Chargers. So, but man, he's been good. We know it. We've known it. We've been talking about it. Everybody sees it. It's been much, much better. It's been improved, and it's been fun to watch.
Well,
so I think everybody's thrilled for Garrett Bowles to be able to bounce back and, you know, have the struggles that he had, but now be able to bounce back and kind of put together so far. We still got a lot of ball left, but so far a complete year. You know, we're not having those back-breaking penalties. And so that's always been the hang-up for Garrett Bowles is just these penalties that just kill you and cost you so much. He's just staying away from those.
Yeah, and, you know, we can debate who said it first, but I think it's pretty clear it happened on this show when everybody else was talking about how, hey, they're not picking up his fifth-year option. He's done. He's not going to be back as a Bronco. And look, the odds kind of painted or looked that way. Usually if the fifth-year option isn't picked up, you're gone. It's happened here. It happens across the league. But, you know, we kind of looked at it like, it's more of a prove-it year. It's more of a, you know, show us if you're worth that kind of money and you're worth another contract. I've always said that I thought, and look, being number one, ranked number one, shocks me.
Yes.
I've always thought that Garrett Bowles was kind of a, you know, middle of the pack tackle, maybe slightly above that, maybe slightly below that when he's, you know, having one of those games where he gets flagged a bunch, but he's kind of middle of the pack. He wasn't terrible. And my argument was, well, you could certainly upgrade from the 12th or 13th or 14th best left tackle in football, but at what cost? It would be expensive in terms of draft capital or money, and there's no, you know, guarantee that the 15th overall pick at left tackle is going to be better than the 13th or 14th left tackle in football. I always thought he was going to be back here in 2021 and beyond. I still think that. Now my question, though, Stoke, is whether or not the Broncos will be able to afford him. They may need to go sign him now while, you know, his stock it's on the rise, but it's not all the way up at this point. It's not as high as it's going to be if this continues for the whole year.
Yeah. I mean, certainly if you're the Broncos, you're looking into that. I mean, I think you've seen him play, and I think the thing to think about, and I'm with you, James. I mean, look, Garrett Bowles, that's what I was trying to tell Broncos country. Has it been perfect for Garrett Bowles? No, but there's a lot worse situations out there than Garrett Bowles being your left tackle. And that was my argument this offseason. And then you go into this next offseason. What's the last thing John Elway wants to do? It's look for a left tackle.
Yeah.
It's go into the draft and have to try to, you know, do we have to draft this guy in the first round again to find a left tackle? I'd rather draft another position in the first round. And certainly you don't want to go in free agency and try to find a left tackle. They're hard to find. And on top of that, it's going to cost you so much money. We've seen it. I mean, we saw it with all the right tackles that we've brought in free agency. So that's the last thing you want to do. And now that Garrett Bowles is actually playing really well, certainly you want to keep him. But you're right. The question is, you know, now it's really the ball's in his court. I think the Broncos would love to keep him and would love to get something done before the end of the season, before he hits free agency. But what does Bowles want to do? Does he want to just wait and see? Or would he take a decent deal right now and be happy with it? I think that's the – but I think that's really the question. I don't think the question is, do they want to keep Garrett Bowles? I mean, that's been answered. Of course they want to keep Garrett Bowles. They don't want to look for a left tackle next year. But you know, can they? Can they keep him? And does he want to stay?
Well, and even if he leaves, which would be disappointing at this point, right? You put in 4 years of developing the guy, and you put up with all the growing pains, and then as soon as he's finally ready to do the job at a high level, he bails. Even if that happened, I still think John Elway's decision not to use the fifth-year option was a good gamble. Because it was 5 or 6 games at the end of the year last year with Drew Locke that Garrett Bowles actually played well. That's a small sample size. You're not quite ready to invest in him. Plus, I think there was a little bit of a, hey, you got to go prove it. I still think they needed to motivate the guy a bit and get him to continue to listen to Mike Munchak, continue to listen to Chris Cooper, kind of keep him on track. I think that not picking up the fifth-year option, I don't know how much it has to do with Garrett Bowles playing this well this year, but it had to do had something to do with it, right? There had to be some motivation there.
Well, I think you're right. When you look at it, I mean, Garrett Bowles needed a little bit of a wake-up call. He needed to be humbled, I think, because we saw some of those penalties, and it was. And Vic Fangio told us we got to teach him what holding is. That's what Vic Fangio said.
Yeah.
And I'm paraphrasing to a certain degree, but that's basically what he said. We got to coach him up on what is holding. And you would see his face. He just didn't understand. It was like he didn't have any concept of how bad he was playing and the penalties and what they were doing to the football team. Well, you don't pick up his option. I think it was an eye opener for Garrett Bowles. And look, he's putting together a great year this year. And so it's you know, it's one of those things now. But you're right. John, no chance they should have picked up his fifth year option. You couldn't have picked up his fifth year option. That would have been insane at the time. And so now you're in a situation where you didn't pick up the option, which nobody would have picked up that option because, you know, with the new CBA, once you pick up that option, it's fully guaranteed. Right?
Well,
there's no wiggle room. It used to be, you know, it was guaranteed for injury only. But, you know, throughout this year, if he would have got injured, it would have been guaranteed. If he didn't get injured, they could have pulled it back. Not anymore. Once you give him that fifth-year option, that thing becomes fully guaranteed, and you certainly didn't want to do that with Garrett Bowles. He had to go out there and earn it and prove it, which he's done. And now, hopefully, the Broncos can get something long-term done with Garrett Bowles where we're not back here this offseason looking for a stinking left tackle.
Well, not only that, but if they had picked up that fifth-year option and the last five games of last season turned out to be an aberration and he regressed, they would have been on the hook for, what, it was $11, $12 million, I forget the exact number, for next year. Plus, with Juwan James opting out this year, he's got guaranteed money last year or next year. They would have had a ton of money tied up in a right tackle and a left tackle for 2021. That they didn't want back. Now it's like, all right, well, you know, hopefully they'll have Bowles here. They'll probably have to pay him a little bit more. It'll cost them some money, but that's the gamble they took. And the only worry they'll have in terms of like, all right, are we going to get anything for our money is Juwan James. Boy, that's a lot better situation. It was avoiding, they were trying to avoid worst case scenario, which certainly was in play because nobody knew Garrett Bowles would play this well. Even you and I, who were optimistic about it, none of us saw this coming.
No, absolutely not. Not this consistent. But to his credit, he's done it, and he put in the work, and he's shown why, you know, because he's always been athletic. It's just been those little things, those little moments, and I think you probably feel the same way. I always felt like he could correct those things. They were just like dumb. Just like, yeah. Hey, just don't play dumb. Just play smart. You know, don't grab the guy, throw him down, and jump on top of him dumb, right? I mean, just don't do that, and you'll be a decent football player. And then if you can cut out a few of the other things, you could be a good football player. And he has actually done it, so credit to him. You know, those are the great stories. A guy that's kind of been beat up around town for three years, you know, comes out in a prove-it year, doesn't get his fifth-year option picked up, and is playing the best football of his life and, you know, is rated number one by Pro Football Focus. Is that what it is? Look, kudos to him. Hopefully the Broncos can get something done with them because that you don't want that box not checked off this offseason. You want to check that thing and say, that's one thing that we don't have to worry about, left tackle. I mean, that's a prominent premium position. You don't want to have to worry about that this offseason.
Well, and they're also setting up with he and Dalton Risner, potentially, hey, the left side of the offensive line we don't have to worry about.
Good point.
They still got a lot of holes to fill, so if you can just put those two guys down in pen – okay, you can start moving on to other things, so certainly a good situation. All right, the Broncos got rolled by the Chiefs on Sunday. How much of a reality check was it? We'll check in with our Cecil Lammy about that coming up next.
Miss any of Stokely and Zach? Make sure to subscribe to our on-demand podcast. You'll get every episode as soon as they're released. Just subscribe wherever you get your podcasts or at 104.3thefan.com.